This is the second day of this February 2013 two-day Sesshin. And today I'll be discussing several things, starting with pain, and then, starting a short discussion of pain, and then getting into the discussion of the now rather famous default mode network, and then finally turning to a book by one Gary Weber, Happiness Beyond Thought, A Practical Guide to Awakening. So first, pain. I wrote this a while back. The question is, what is normal and natural with regard to ordinary pain, like the pain of Zazen? Especially with the pain we tend to feel late in the round. The first step would be to feel it fully, not to take refuge by separating oneself, which would mean going off into a vortex of thoughts about the pain and how you might avoid the pain, wanting to move, considering moving. This would be a way of resisting reality, the reality of the pain. I had a neighbor back in Madison who used to run marathons. He did quite a few marathons. And he reported to me that he'd have to go deep into thoughts and daydreams in order not to feel the pain. That may actually work to some extent, but surely it wouldn't help us uncover our true nature. Being normal with regard to pain would also mean not responding to it with some self-image, such as the tough guy, or I'm the wimpy type who really can't stand pain. When a tough guy or woman fails to respond appropriately to pain, she or he can get himself into big trouble. To respond normally in this profound, profoundly normal, we need to find ways to sit that will be comfortable enough to make good Zazen possible and not get us into long-term trouble by overstressing our joints or whatever. We all know this. Pain is, after all, an important guide in life. It points to something that must be carefully evaluated. But on the other side, we also mustn't let ourselves go crazy in trying to find a way to avoid all pain. Some pain is clearly a part of the practice. It's meant to be a necessary part of the practice, in fact, and that's because it gives us strong impetus to take refuge in concentration. Our concentration is often called involvement with the practice. And it's this complete absorption in the practice that can take the sting out of pain, at least, and sometimes make it possible to transcend pain altogether for short periods. Now I want to turn to something that more and more people are talking about. And it's a very important part of understanding what's happening in Zazen. And also an important part of having faith in Zazen. This was written on May 30th last year. And a man named Roger Wells writes, last year, a Harvard study confirmed that there's a clear connection between mind wandering and unhappiness. Not only did the study find that if you're awake, your mind is wandering almost half the time, it also found that this wandering is linked to a less happy state. This is not surprising, since when your mind is wandering, it's not generally to sweet things in your life. More likely, it's to thoughts like why your electric bill was so high, why your boss was rude today, or why your ex-husband is being so difficult. Another study found that mind wandering is linked to activation of a network of brain cells, which is being called the default mode network. This network is not active when you're doing high-level processing, but when we're drifting about in, but it is active when we're drifting about in self-referential thoughts. Read, when our brain is flitting from one life worry to the next. Meditation is an interesting method for increasing one's sense of happiness because not only has it stood the test of time, but it's also been tested quite extensively in the lab. Part of the effect of mindfulness meditation, or what we're doing here, is to quiet the mind by acknowledging non-judgmentally and then relinquishing rather than obsessing about unhappy or stress-inducing thoughts. New research by someone, Judson Brewer, PhD, and his group at Yale, has found that experienced meditators not only report less mind wandering during meditation, but actually have markedly decreased activity in their default mode network. Earlier research had shown that meditators have less activity in regions governing thoughts about the self, like the medial prefrontal cortex. Brewer says that what's likely going on in experienced meditators is that those me centers of the brain are being deactivated. They also found that when the brain's me centers were activated, meditators also co-activated areas important in self-monitoring and cognitive control, which may indicate that they are on the constant lookout for me thoughts or mind wandering. And when their minds do wander, they bring them back to the present moment. Even better, meditators not only did this during meditation, but when not being told to do anything in particular. This suggests that they may have formed a new default mode, one that is more present-centered and less me-centered, no matter what they're doing. I have a photo of the brain I was going to bring it out, but since I really can't show it to anybody here right now, it shows the brain and it shows where they're mapping out this default mode network. Certain areas of the brain light up, and they've pretty much located where all this is going on in the brain, actually four different regions, and they're all linked together. And now we'll get to happiness beyond thought. And what I wanted to read, especially in this, is a thing called The Case for Practice in Awakening. There are some reputedly enlightened folk who have taught that there is nothing to be done as we are already enlightened. They further contend that all practice is meaningless and a diversion. Others say that practice is only useful to convince others that we cannot get enlightened through practice. They believe that practice is done only so that we become so frustrated that we simply surrender our ego and its attempts, after which enlightenment just happens. These viewpoints are reinforced by the lack of any apparent pattern or consistency to the situations in which enlightenment experiences occur. Some have been enlightened walking across a park, others when they kicked a stone against a bamboo, and others when they visited a house of prostitution. Still others were awakened when they stepped off a curb or when they were waiting for a bus. In the author's case, it occurred while doing a yoga posture that had been done thousands of times before. These unpredictable events, which are clearly beyond any plausible cause and effect relationship, are taken as proof of the impossibility of making enlightenment happen. Similarly, the pattern and type of practice that preceded awakening is in some ways always different. insisting that you follow a precise path that would work for your teacher is guaranteed to be inadequate in some way. Any student, no matter how diligent and well-prepared, is going to be different from the teacher in conditioning, experience, age, genetics, family history, bodily and mental capability, etc. How could something as complex and comprehensive as awakening not be a personally tailored process? This man, Gary Weber, attained a very, very deep awakening after 20,000 hours of practice. Now, 1,000 hours, that's about, if you just practiced an hour a day, that's about 3 years. So at an hour a day, that's 60 years of practice. 2 hours a day, it's only 30 hours of practice. That's about what he did. There's an emerging, scientifically validated view on the necessity of practice that is gaining significant credibility. The traditional belief in neuroscience was that the brain was born with all the neurons it was ever going to have, and that experience or training did not change their functional pattern. However, neurophysiologic research on brain functioning is currently being done in legitimate scientific laboratories by top-ranked scientists with the latest tools. These tools include functional magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, and high-resolution electroencephalography. These experiments demonstrate the existence of what has been called neuroplasticity, or the ability of the brain to change its functional operational pattern with practice or experience. In this work, experienced meditators have a very different mode of processing sensory inputs and generating and controlling mental states than untrained, inexperienced people. It has been demonstrated that these untrained, inexperienced people can be trained in a relatively short time to show a change in their functional neural pattern as well. In these studies, musical training has been used as a model for what happens with neuroplasticity. MRI studies on violinists have shown that the brain regions that control fingering movements grow in size. Longer and more intensive practice produces bigger changes. How much training is required to generate meaningful changes in the brain leading to extraordinary capabilities in playing the violin? What about chess, Olympic sports, sculpting, etc.? There will always be savants or the Mozarts. For the vast majority of us, it's necessary to do lengthy and intensive practice. It was found that those at the top of their fields in many disciplines had significantly different associated muscle fibers, brain functional patterns, and cognitive abilities. For the violinists, those at the top level had practiced for about 10,000 hours. Those at the next lower level, about 7,500 hours. The most extraordinary meditator in the most detailed neurophysiologic study had meditated for over 10,000 hours. Surprisingly, decades before there were any sophisticated tools to demonstrate such a controversial and unexpected possibility, that is, change in the brain, J. Krishnamurti often claimed, that was Jiddu Krishnamurti from Ojai, California, who I mentioned yesterday, often claimed that there was an organic change in the structure of the brain that accompanied enlightenment. Gary goes on. As a personal anecdote, my journey started with a totally unexpected and unprecedented, for me, dramatic spiritual experience with no preparation or practice. However, Because there had been no preparation or practice, I just couldn't hold it. I was clueless. Despite much subsequent practice of yoga and meditation and other experiences, the page didn't turn until someplace in this 9,000 hours category for each. An approximation, as I wasn't using a stopwatch. He says, perhaps I'm a slow learner of spiritual stuff. I don't think so, which is a distinct possibility. Perhaps my intellectual nature, training, and professional life slowed things. Perhaps my practices were not additive, that is, they one and one made one and a half instead of two. Perhaps my attachments were so heavily rooted that it took long to let go. This is all mental speculation of no consequence. It was just as it was. It will be different for you. It does seem that my students, he says, are having an easier time than I had, which is all to the good, although that too is just as it is. If this research is correct, it might explain why very few can perform any number. Wait a minute here. If this research is correct, it might explain why very few can perform any number of tasks at a transcendent master level without extensive practice. Without extensive reshaping of the neural patterns and functioning of the brain, the mechanics are not sufficiently patterned that transcendent creativity and performance can emerge. This transcendent creativity has been described by many masters, ranging from Cezanne to Picasso to Einstein, Crick, the discoverer of DNA, and Kekulé, the discoverer of a key structure of much of biology. All these masters were extremely proficient and well-trained in their craft before they could be conduits for the transcendent insight and creativity. Picasso's and Michelangelo's early work demonstrated their consummate skill at crafting that would pave the way for their later expressions of transcendent creativity. Indeed, there are few skills that do not require functional mastery before reaching the level at which the activity can become so automatic that something extraordinary or transcendent can occur. In something as prosaic as riding a bicycle, we start with a tricycle, graduate to a two-wheeler with training wheels before removing the training wheels, riding with one hand and then no hands. Why would enlightenment be a chance occurrence made no more likely through some... Why would enlightenment be a chance occurrence made no more likely through some preparation? Virtually all self-realized folk who proclaim that there is nothing that can be done in preparation for enlightenment and who give adequate biographies went through years of spiritual discipline before the apparently serendipitous triggering event occurred. Isn't it more likely that there's a process that does modify the brain in a way that increases concentration and detachment and creates a different functional pattern? Increasingly, even amongst those who have enlightenment experiences with little apparent prior preparation, there is further support for the necessity of practice. The common observation that these enlightened folk who are open about their own process is that there is a settling in period of several years after enlightenment before realization is stable and clear. Perhaps this settling in period continues until a functional neural network repatterning process is completed. One has to think that that's what Bodhidharma was doing for 9 years in his cave there. And he's talking, this man, Gary Weber, regards Ramana Maharshi as the Indian sage, as his ultimate teacher. He says, Although Ramana had little preparation prior to his awakening, that was at the age of 16, he spent many years after the experience meditating and remaining silent, apparently grounding and stabilized the realization. Ramana Maharshi described this as jnana, jhana. Once revealed, and he says, jhana, once revealed, takes time to steady itself. The self, with a capital S, remains veiled by vasanas, latent impressions or tendencies, and reveals itself only in their absence. To remain stabilized in it, further efforts are necessary. Ramana told countless seekers that each should pursue practice appropriate to their capabilities and interests. Although his focus with many was on meditative inquiry through questions such as, who am I, and from where does this I arise, and recognizing that you are not this body, he encouraged others to work with mantras, reciting texts, or devotional practices. Among Ramana's close followers, the one best known was in the West was H.W.L. Punja, or Punjaji. His clear teaching and understanding of Ramana's work were a critical element in my journey. Few teachers have been so straightforward and direct in communicating their understanding. Punjaji said in the latter part of his life, you do not have to practice any sadhanas, any spiritual preparation, any practice. However, few aspirants could match Punjaji's own intense preparation, sadhana. At one point, Punjaji would chant daily from 2:30 a.m. to 9:30 a.m. before going to work. After work, he would chant until he went to sleep. His standard practice was to do 50,000 recitations each day, synchronizing the chanting with his breathing. Punjaji did many forms of traditional worship, including reciting the names of the divine, as japa it's called in India, and as well as mantras and prayers with great fervor. Punjaji said that the turning point in his practice was when he realized from Ramana Maharshi, that he should have been asking the question, who am I, all along? Even a realized master who reaches the point that practice is no longer necessary went through exhaustive preparations and practice. Without his preparation, would Punjaji have really understood the need for exploring the I in quotation marks, the ego? Were all those hours of practice of no value in developing the concentration and detachment that allowed his transcendent understanding to emerge? The answer is, of course not. Stephen Harrison, another contemporary non-dualist teacher and writer, had a very similar experience. In his excellent book, Doing Nothing, Coming to the End of the Spiritual Search, Stephen detailed how he, quote, sought out every mystic, seer, and magician he could find anywhere. He described his 25 years of study of philosophies, severe austerities, periods of isolation and meditation. He concluded, it was all useless. Harrison described the recognition similar to that of Punjaji and that of Ramana, that the problem was that every experience, no matter how profound, was collected by the me. The problem was the collector. But was that extensive preparation really useless just because it was no longer necessary? Isn't it possible that the practices gave him the ability to concentrate and detach so that he could recognize that the problem was the me and then to hold on to that understanding? Similarly, Tony Parsons, a contemporary Advaita teacher and author of the outstanding As It Is, describes how hard he applied himself to various disciplines, rituals, and purifications. Tony states that his awakening happened almost as if by accident. in walking across a park? Isn't it possible that his spiritual work laid the framework for the triggering event to occur? Spiritual teachers rejecting earlier practices as unnecessary seems no more reasonable than an Olympic high diver saying that since she no longer jumps off the side of the pool as she did as a beginner, that it was unnecessary. Similarly, a concert violinist would not claim that years of practicing scales and fingerings were unnecessary because now she no longer needs them. Having the ability to recognize clearly that the problem is not the search, but the one driving the search, appears to require some training of the mind. Practice is necessary not just to recognize its futility, but also to have developed the ability to concentrate and detach. With this learning, you can be the witness standing outside the mind, body, and senses and see the real problem. In response to questions about the necessity of effort in a practice to gain enlightenment, Ramana Maharshi said, quote, "No one succeeds without effort. Mind control is not one's birthright. The successful few owe their success to their perseverance." I think this is terribly important that we get realistic about what is required, especially important so people don't lose heart, don't spend a lot of years in this preparation and feel it was all for nothing because nothing big has happened yet. This is terribly important in Zen practice to have the faith that you're changing the brain. You're shrinking the default mode network. You're gradually becoming much less self-centered. And if you persist, you will succeed. Finally, I'd like to read a section that he wrote about inquiry. A critical and unique aspect of this approach, that is inquiry, what is mu, who am I, is that meditative inquiry is not confined to the time you have available to spend sitting in a meditative posture. The process can continue 16 or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in whatever you are doing. As you extend the meditation from the defined period of a sitting practice into your daily life, select a daily periodic activity to trigger you to re-engage with the question. Select a periodic activity to trigger you to re-engage with the question. That's a very important trick. This reminder, whether it's answering the phone, beginning eating, going to the bathroom, traveling to work, having a cup of tea, every odd-numbered hour, etc., will move you back into the depths and immediacy of your inquiry. It's particularly powerful if you use the inquiry as the first thing on waking to establish the tone for the day and the last thing before falling asleep, to place it into consciousness so that it will continue during the night. With inquiry of this intensity, before long, things will begin to change in your life, some subtle, some not so subtle. There's a misconception that nothing happens until the Big Bang of enlightenment. Nothing could be further from the truth. Your heart will be lightened before and whether or not an enlightenment event ever happens. Focusing your process on getting a special experience that you can tell your friends about as soon as possible can significantly hinder your work. Creating a powerful ego to drive to a goal is the very ego that you will in the end need to discard to reach beyond the mind. You do not suddenly master playing the piano, speaking a foreign language, rock climbing, painting abstract art, or doing mathematical equations. You get better and more effortlessly capable as you continue your practice and as your concentration, capacity, and understanding develop. Whether or not you become Picasso, Einstein, or flawlessly fluent in French, so it is with meditative inquiry. And he has a little section here. What if you get bored? When should you change your practice? Your practice will at times be unpleasant and feel hard and dry. You will feel like it is not moving as you think it should be in a continuously upward trajectory. You will see parts of your mind and thoughts that surprise, disappoint, frighten, and depress you in greater profusion than you were ever aware of before. Inquiry has not somehow mysteriously created them. They were there all along. With everything else out of the way, they now have a chance to manifest. With persistent inquiry, your thoughts will lose their strength and energy. Some may still come back repeatedly. Eventually, they will have smaller, duller hooks than they used to have to snag you and pull you into an obsessive stream of thoughts. They will trouble you less and less. And I'd like to add, as you reduce the power of thought over you, automatically awareness increases. You may also find, even after you have apparently achieved some progress and perhaps had some spiritual experiences, that practice will appear to have stalled, become lifeless, and lost in its capacity to engage you. When this occurs, persist for some time. See if it's just the mind's resistance and conditioning trying to derail the process. Leave the inquiry alone for a while and take a break, and then return to it. See if your interest in the inquiry has returned. If not, then it's time for the next step to manifest. And this is where, of course, in our tradition, this is where we consult with the teacher. See how working together can help you. Maybe change the practice. We don't know. Whatever. What you can find to be able to continue the work. So there is no need for disappointment after long practice apparently yielding no results, or there's no legitimate grounds for negative judgments about oneself. There's no ground for others to make negative judgments about anybody. There needs to be a widespread recognition that this work isn't really significant until thousands of... It will not yield obvious results, perhaps, until thousands of hours of meditation, thousands of hours of practice. If we have this recognition, we can all support each other more significantly. We can drop our own negative judgments. Also, there doesn't need to be there needs to be work, solid work that one puts in constantly. But there doesn't need to be this obsessive grasping is of the ego. It's very negative for practice. What you want to do is see their tendency to obsess, to grasp, and drop it. Just work hard. Work without any thought about results. This man, Gary Weber, he when he came to a very deep enlightenment, he was doing a yoga posture. And he had no idea that such a thing would come. He had no expectation whatsoever that what would come or even that what came was even possible. His thoughts stopped for the most part. He became much more effective in many, many ways. May all beings attain Buddhahood.